have an AA meeting. My name is Megan, and I'm an alcoholic.
Megan.
Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the Napa Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describe in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight will be listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org. Desperately in need, we'll hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight's speaker is Nick S. from the Fun of It group of the Serenity House of Buford.
Hey, guys. I'm Nick. I'm an alcoholic. This is a real honor. Thank you for this. I usually start my day off like this or anything like this, so I'm going to open this thing up with a prayer, one that's important to me and one that changed me a lot. So,
the third step prayer.
God, I offer myself to Thee to build with me and do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me from the bondage of self that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help with Thy power, Thy love, and Thy way of life. May I do Thy will always. Man, did I not know what that prayer meant when I first said it. My God. I'll start off, I was born in 1986. I have a home group. I'm an alcoholic, and I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor. I sponsor men in the program. And I have a service position in my home group. My sobriety date is September 5th, 2016. 2016. Anyway, that went by pretty fast. But I'll start out. So I was born to an alcoholic mother. I don't know if that has anything to do with me being an alcoholic. I don't. I'll tell you why I'm an alcoholic is because when I drink, I want another drink more than I wanted that first one. That's it. It's not because of my mother. It's not because of anything else. It's because when I drink, I have an allergic reaction that normal people don't have. And for me, it's the only normal thing. The other part, it seems to be everything, every thought that I have when I'm doing my own thoughts and I'm controlling my own life will lead me to a drink. There's two parts to it. But that's it. You know, that's it. That's why I'm an alcoholic. I do a lot of things alcoholically. I don't know if my past had anything to do with it, but my mother was an alcoholic. We partied a lot. We're from Doraville, right outside of Liberty Heights. I don't know if y'all know where that is, but it's a pretty fun neighborhood to live in. And that's where I come from, and that's what we did. So Christmases were fun until the guns and the liquor and the violence started. I mean, it was a good old redneck party. That's just where I come from, right out there off Buford Highway. My mother saw something wrong with that, and she decided to move us out of there. When we were two, she met my stepdad, and he adopted both of us. Good man. Really good man. Country boy. Didn't know anything about this. Completely got hoodwinked, and for the next 7 years of his life, a couple of bankruptcies later and things like that, you know, he finally divorced her. But childhood was, I thought it was good until I talked to my psychiatrist a little bit. But I thought my childhood was good. It was the only one that I knew. It was normal. There was a lot of love, you know, a lot of gifts. A couple of late night, you know, rambunctiousness. I do remember that they didn't spare the rod with me, and sometimes the rod made it to my face and my head, but that's okay. You know, that's okay. It didn't teach me the lesson that I needed to learn, I guess, apparently. Growing up, I made it through school, but I remember there's one thought I remember having, and I don't remember when I had this, but I looked out, maybe I was 7 or 8 or something, I looked out, and I said, I ain't like them. Simultaneously, at the same time, I realized the universe revolves around me, because from my perspective, everything revolves around me. Like, this is everything, like, what I do, and so I'm different, but unique, but everything kind of revolves around me, so I better watch what people are. People can see what I'm thinking. People could do, you know, a lot of insecurity started to happen. But that That I think is is, in my opinion, a form of alcoholism. But what I had was the beginnings of selfishness and self-centeredness. My life surrounded by men. If y'all, Mom got sober at some point in time. I started acting up. She got sober. She found her way into Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew that something changed. You know, she went from weekends being passed out to mommy has a headache, not really being there, to suddenly she was a mommy again, and things would go pretty well, and then it wouldn't go well, and then it would go well, and then it wouldn't go well, and then suddenly it was like well again. And that was kind of like my childhood. That was my experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. But by that time, I was pissed. And I'll be honest with you, alcoholism is a dirty thing. People suffer. People that the children, parents, the brothers, the sisters, anybody close to me or anybody with the alcoholic disease suffers much more than the alcoholic. See, we have a solution. We can drink. The children can't, and I couldn't drink. So I tried to find any other excuse, but the only thing that I could resort to was anger and rage. And that's where I went, and depression. And so I started missing school. I wasn't really the best child in school. I wasn't the smartest one. I made it to about sixth grade before I was kicked out. And that's about as far as I made it. But by that time, the state of Georgia says that you can choose the parent that you live with. So I moved in with my stepdad at the age of about 12 years old. And that's about the time I found my first drink. Yeah, that's about the time I found the first anything that could change the way I felt. And I'll tell you, it wasn't my first drink. It wasn't like I thought it would be. It wasn't like no walls fell. It wasn't like the end of the world. It was actually okay. But I didn't have that thing, that spring in my gut. It loosened it a little bit. So very shortly thereafter, with my mother being an alcoholic and about 2 years sober in the program, Alcoholics Anonymous recognized some signs and swept me up and put me into a children's place very quickly. It's called Atlanta Inns. I don't know if that rings any bells, but it was for kids, and you know, it was fun. The first thing they did was took me out of public school. Second thing they did was told my parents they should buy me cigarettes, because if I can smoke cigarettes, I won't do outside issues and I won't drink. So just ran around the city of Atlanta for a couple of years and met some really cool people. But I still had this thing, and I didn't know what alcoholism was, but I knew I wasn't my mother. You know, I knew I wasn't that. So about 15 years old, not in school, I left that weird group, and then I decided that I was just going to start my career. So I started with the easiest things that you can find when you're a teenager, which definitely isn't alcohol, because you need an ID for that. So I tried a couple of things, and then one day I asked my brother, Joey, I said, "Hey, man, I really feel like crap. What should I do?" He said, "Go get you some Old English 800 and drink it. You got a 4 ounce." And I said, "Okay." So I did that. And again, it was a solution for all the things I was going through. But one thing I realized is, I'm going to tell you exactly what drinking did for me. It's right here in the book. When I started drinking, I knew a new freedom and I knew a new happiness. I did not regret the past nor to shut the door on it. I comprehended the word serenity. I knew peace. No matter how far down the scale I had gone, I could see how my experience could benefit others. I'd sit there in the bar and I could tell you everything there was to know about everything there was to know. When I was on alcohol, it was a good solution. So all these things that drinking is bad didn't make any sense to me. It was good. It was a very good thing for me. And I still think that. If it still worked for me, if it still did those things for me, guys, I'd still be drinking right now. Problem is, it doesn't. It doesn't. It took more and more. And the drinking, it takes more and more to achieve less and less. Though there in the very beginning, it gave me a lot. And I had minimal consequences from it. And it was a lot less dangerous than some of the other stuff I was doing. So, emotionally, I don't know if I was emotionally, but I thought it'd be a good idea to join a gang at some point in time. So that's what I did. And I started running around with some guys that were doing some things in the streets that were pretty crazy. And I was hopping in and out of there. My parents didn't really know what was going on. By this time, my mother was sick with cancer. She had terminal cancer at this time, and she was dying somewhere, and I didn't care. I didn't care. I did. I would go over there and see her, but there was no room for me to care about anything other than getting another one. By the time I was 16, 17 years old, I was using things that I shouldn't have been, and I was drinking daily, and I was fine. You couldn't tell me anything. I was running around the streets. I started to get arrested. My first arrest when I was 17. Spent about a week in jail for a DUI, and then the next arrest was shoplifting, and started my career off with the Gwinnett County police, I guess you could say. And I started going to jail. I'd go in and out of jail, and the pattern was I'd get out. I'd go in for Christmases, I'd go in for birthdays, and I'd be out during the summertime, and I'd go in and go out, and go in and go out, and everybody was trying to help me. Everybody had something to help me. They all knew, the judges knew about where I should go, and it was true. And they would send me to a halfway house, or they'd send me here, and they always knew where I was supposed to go. But as soon as I would get there, I'll tell you a story. I went to jail, and I ended up going into prison. I went to a halfway house down in South Atlanta, and I really didn't want to drink or do anything anymore. I really didn't. I was not going to. So I went there, and about a month in, I decided to sneak out the window, and go across the gas station, get a drink, come back, and then go back to prison. That's what I decided. That's the way it was, because there was nothing in my mind that told me, there was nothing in my experience that told me I was going to be okay without taking something from outside of myself and putting it to myself. You know, it wasn't. I was not somebody who could do that. I saw y'all do that. I would come to meetings, I'd see all of you guys just happy, joyous, laughing, stuff like that. And I'm like, that ain't me. I have to have something inside me. So, tried medications. I went to some psychiatrists, and I let them pump me full of pills and things like that because I was convinced. From my perspective, I could not survive without something, without taking something. So for a short time, medication would help, but then eventually I drank again. And this is the pattern. This is my pattern. I've been through the drug courts. I've been through the DUI courts. I've been through everything. And finally, I just gave up. I just gave up and said, I'm gonna quit trying to quit. That was probably the best decision I ever made, I think, because that was the beginning of it. I lived with my dad, my stepdad, who adopted me from my mother, and I lived with him, and I would go to jail from his house. He would have to pick me up off the floor. I had all kinds of other people at the house that were very dangerous people. We got robbed several times, the house emptied several times. There was a couple of times I messed up with a vehicle, and a couple of Russian guys came over and waited for me to come home. But, of course, I couldn't come home because I was stuck in some house somewhere in Atlanta, and I didn't know where I was at. Luckily, my dad stayed safe. You know, I put my family in danger, but that was it. I loved my dad. I thought I loved my dad. If I really loved my dad, I don't think I would have put him through these things. But I didn't have a choice. This time, I didn't have a choice. You know, the first step says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable. I mean, my life was unmanageable, completely unmanageable. I was unemployable. I was unhelpable. And inside, I hurt. I hurt. And I didn't hurt because of the things I was doing. I didn't hurt because of that. I hurt because if I didn't have a drink, it would be so intense, such an intense feeling inside me that I had to relieve it or I wanted to die. And that's where I was at. And I didn't even realize that drinking was the problem. I thought it was all these other things. I thought it was the crimes. I thought it was this. But I drank throughout it all. So I guess you could say I kind of caught alcoholism. So I'm gonna fast forward a little bit to the last time. I'm on bond for robbery, two burglaries, false imprisonment, battery, forgery, and a few other charges, misdemeanors, or something like that. I'm on bond for a lot of stuff. I'm about to do a lot of time. And I called a buddy of mine who lives in Mexico, and I said, "Hey, I'm going to come out to Mexico." And he's like, "Okay, come out to Mexico. Come on, I'm going to do that with my. I'm just going to. I don't know how I'm going to get there, but I'm going to go on the run." I made it from Lawrenceville Swanee Road to about Satellite before I don't remember anything. I made it to there. And I remember what I had bought. I remember what I had in my pocket. And when I woke up in the hospital a few days later, I didn't have any of it. So whatever happened, I just took it all alcoholically. And I remember, the last thing I remember is losing a $5 bet on a shot of pool. And then I wake up in the jail's hospital infirmary, and they said, "You've been non-responsive for a week." They asked me what date it was, and I told them what date it was. Like, "Yeah, it's a week later." They asked me my name, and I realized I couldn't really talk right. I'd been out for a little while. Showed up non-responsive, and then nobody would tell me why I was there. I had no idea why I was there. But I do know this. I do know that I died. Yep, I died for a little while, and they brought me back. But something inside me died, and I think that living like that, it beat me into submission for just long enough. It humbled me in that I had to be humbled by alcohol. I had to be humbled long enough for some sort of message to come in, any message. And so when I'm there, they had me under some sort of observatory thing where they like to observe you just to make sure they don't really know what happened, just when they figure out who you are. And something broke. I said, "I need a book. Read me a book." And they brought me a book. They brought me a Star Trek book, and then they brought me another book. Just happened to be somebody's testimony that suffered from the same thing that I suffer from. And I couldn't read the Star Trek book, but I read this guy's book, and it just fell in line with everything that I've been doing. He had found a way of life that involved God. And he said, "If you want this way of life, we'll do some certain things." So before I even knew what I was doing, I got on my knees and I prayed. And I prayed and I asked God to. I just asked God to do it. Because if I can't die properly, then let's do something okay. You know what I mean? Like, come on. Let's do something. So I got on my knees, and it was a very, very cool experience because, I hear people have their white light experiences and things like that. Mine was a little different. I was everybody that I had hurt, and I was pain, and I was emotionally just in turmoil for days, and I was like, "Oh God, this sucks." So, and then finally that broke as well. And the first things, my first recollection of thoughts, I was like, "I need to go to an AA meeting and a Bible." That was it. And I'm in jail, so how am I going to get that? So, turns out that you guys actually bring AA meetings into jail. Who would have thought, right? So as soon as I got to a point, I put in a little request, and as soon as I got to a point, I found an AA meeting, and I went there, and I started listening to these guys speak, and I was feeling good at this time, because something happens for me. I get away from the drink for a little while, and I really forget where I was. So my forgetter is great, and all of a sudden, like, I got my judgment back, and I'm judging you, and you don't know what to tell me, and I'm just a smart aleck. So my sponsor, he used to say, "You were bulletproof." That's the word he uses. I was bulletproof. So I came to these jail AA meetings. I'd sit there and I'd listen and I'd do that. And they started talking about these things called sponsors, right? And I'd heard of a sponsor, but no way in hell was I ever going to tell somebody what I'd done and sit there and actually do that. But they talked about these sponsors, and they talked about the program, and my idea was I was just going to sit in these meetings, and through osmosis, you guys were just going to feed me, and I was going to suck in the way of life, and then suddenly be okay, right? It doesn't really work that way. But I remember a guy telling a story about some crazy stuff that he had done behind the pulpit, and I was like, that's my kind of guy. I mean, just twisted, like, doing this. I can't even say it. That's his story. But I found my sponsor that day. I said, "Yeah, I need a guy like that. I need a guy who really understands it, who really understands what it's like to be crazy," right? So I got with him, and I was staying up at night. I had done some things before I got locked up. I'd stolen a pistol from my dad, and I promised I'd never steal anything, and it was one of those things I was never going to do, but I stole a pistol from my dad. The plan was to take it to somebody, get some stuff in, sell it, and then come back and get it back, and it turns out the whole stuff was fake, and I just got ripped off, and it was terrible, and that was part of the whole thing. But he always asked me, he's like, did you take that gun? And he would come to visit me, and he was putting money on my books. He was loving me, and I didn't deserve it. I would look at him, and I'd say, "Dad, no, I didn't." And I sat down with the guy, and I said, I got to tell my dad about it. He said, "Well, I think you should probably wait until you work some steps before you get to the amends part." That's what he told me. But I followed most of my suggestions from my sponsor, but this one I didn't. And I'm actually glad. I wrote my dad a letter and said, "Hey, look, I'm about to go away for a long time. here's who I actually am. Here's what I've done to you. If you want to still love me after this, then great. I got to make amends to him. And then a couple weeks later, I got a call if he had had a brain aneurysm and died. So I'm glad I did that. But that's one of the few times, I don't suggest not taking your sponsor's advice, but that was one of the few times I'm actually grateful that I did, because I didn't get to make amends to my mother when she passed. I live with that every day. But I did get to, for the most part, make amends to him. But there I sat. I thought that I'd hit a bottom, and it just got lower. For me, when I got sober, it started getting worse. The alcoholism was catching up. The life was catching up to me. And I had no insulation for it. So I felt the smallest thing. You looked at me the wrong way, I wanted to cry, man. You know what I mean? You had anything wrong with something I did, I was obsessing about it every day. I know what obsession was, but I know what it is now, and I still have that. But then you say one thing to me, and I'm just like, ugh. And I had no insulation. All I had was a cell to stare at and books. And so I started reading this big book. And I went there, and I went to this AA meeting. I went to this AA meeting in the jail, and I sat down, and I shared, and I just started crying. I said, my dad died. I need y'all. I'm sold. Like, what is this thing that y'all have? And the man who still sponsors me today pulled me aside, and he took me through the first three steps. And then he said, I want you to go back to your dorm and write an inventory. And be very careful about the inventory that you write, because, you know, you don't want to say anything blatantly, but write an inventory, and I'll be here next week, and we'll do that. So it went something like this. He said, do you think you're powerless over alcohol? I said, yeah. Do you think your life is unmanageable? Yeah, I really do. Do you believe that a power greater than yourself could restore you to sanity? Well, I didn't have a choice. I didn't believe or not believe. I had no choice but to believe something out there other than me, because I tried everything. Then he held out his hands and got on his knees, which I thought was curious. You know, in jail, get on your knees with a man, but we said a prayer. We said that same prayer, that third step prayer. And he didn't warn me. He didn't warn me before we said that third step prayer. He says, God, I offer myself to you to build with me and do with me as you will. That's great. Because all I see is the end picture. But in building and construction or anything, anybody with logical sense or a mind that understands this knows that there's a reconstruction period. You got to rip some things out first. So we said that prayer, and I was in the midst of getting my whole life ripped out. Everything, which was pretty much everything that I had, was just gone. Family, love. God doesn't give us the blueprint. That's just the bottom line. He doesn't. I'm glad he does. It says, relieve me of my difficulties. Well, maybe that happened, maybe it didn't. I know that when I went to court, they said, Nick, you're a career criminal. We're not going to let you off this. You're going to do your time. And I said, well, maybe, okay, I'll do my time. And they're like, what? And I was like, yeah, I'll do whatever. I said, I want to pay my debt to society, whatever it is, just give me something where I can get help. Because if I don't get help, I'm going to be back before you over and over and over again until I don't leave. And they were, I don't know if the court system, that threw them back or not. I'd already been through every program they could possibly go to. You know, I went to court and I said, okay, we'll work with that simultaneously. At the same time, I went and did this four step with my sponsor, who is now my sponsor. He wasn't sponsoring me in jail, but he's my sponsor now. And I went and did this fourth step. And it was the first fourth step. It was just stuff I did that I could not think about. And I just listed these things and I just told them to somebody. It was the first time I'd ever told anybody all these things in a row. Like, if you were involved with something with me, yeah, you knew some things. Or if you were over here, yeah, you may know some things. But the way I did it, I was like, I might tell this person, this person, this person. But there was stuff I was taking to the grave, never telling anybody. And I told them this stuff, and it was a pretty cool experience. I went home and I slept like a baby. Or I went back to my cell and I slept like a baby. So pretty cool experiences. Ended up going to court. They gave me a plea, and I said the same thing to the judge, and he said, okay, well, we'll give you rehab. So 20-year sentence turned into 18 months. I said, I did this. I'm responsible. My co-defendants don't have anything to do with it. They were just a group of guys that were compiled together, and I led this, and they didn't have anything to do with it, and everybody got off, so it turned into 18 months in a rehab. And I remember a prayer that I said, a very scary prayer. I got on my knees and I said, God, if you get me out of this and you give me a little bit of success, I will turn around and I will give it all back to you. That was my prayer. That was a scary prayer. That was a scary thing to say. So I went up, got out, I got out and I went to this place called the Oxford House. And I asked my sponsor, I said, hey, man, I've been sober for like 2 years now, like 18 months, almost 2 years now, and everything. I'm sober, right? And he's like, yeah, you're sober, but not quite. It's time to really start working the steps and really get down. I was like, oh, cool, cool. We'll work the steps, but I need a girlfriend. So so I got out, and I went to this Serenity House up here, and I was riding around, and I made it a couple weeks, and then I found my little girlfriend, and that was really cool. And just like drinking, nothing happened. Nothing bad happened immediately. Found me a little girlfriend. But inside I said, that was nice. If one is nice, why don't you two? Okay, and so then here I am trying to juggle one girl from probation and another girl from the gym that I was working at. And then I was like, well, you know, let's just throw another one in the mix too. So here I am trying to juggle three girls, work the steps with my sponsor. I'm out of prison for 3 months, literally like living a miracle life. I'm a manager of a gym. I don't know how this is happening. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to do this. And suddenly, out of nowhere, like I swear, out of nowhere, the desire to drink. Okay, one night. And I drank. This is 90 days out. And I'm telling you, this is just how I do things. 90 days out. I drank. As soon as I drank, I was homeless again. It was terrible. And then, boom, I'm back on my way to prison. They weren't putting up with that. They were not playing with me. I was on my way back to prison. They gave me as much time as they could possibly give me. Oh, funny thing. I had an outside issue that I was playing with at the time. And I took it to the probation office with me because if I left it anywhere, somebody might take it. And I didn't want anyone to take it because I needed it. Right? And that's just the way I was. So that's how I ended up going back to prison. I, you know, took my outside issue up there and they found it. Somehow, these guys are good. They're good at what they do. So I sat down and that was a little bit different. I remember experiencing God in a way at that time, which was just desperation. So I hit another bottom. And funny thing is, remember, I don't have any family to speak of. I mean, I've got friends, I've got y'all. You guys is who I have. I'm getting letters from members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can call a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can, people that visit me are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no family to speak of. They're all gone. And most of them are sitting right here. And I realized, I was like, wow, I really am in the right place. And I talked to my sponsor. I said, you still going to work with me? He's like, yeah. Yeah, I mean, are you going to do that again? I was like, no. He's like, okay, well, let's work. So he wrote me and that was 2016, September 5th, 2016. That was my last sobriety day, my last arrest date. And I promise you I'm not sober because I got arrested. I got arrested 24 times previously. If it was the consequences, I would have done it a long time ago. Now, this time was different. This time, I had a big book. This is the big book I carried with me through prison. It's got the stains on it and everything. And what's funny is I've read through this a few times now. I go through it with my sponsor, and I still have this one because every time I read this big book, there's new words in it. Every single time. I'll do it with other guys. Every single time there's new words in it. But I know it's not because this went through prison with me. And I still have it. This is it. What I heard the first time that I worked the first step was, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, and because I'm powerless over alcohol, my life is unmanageable. That's what I heard. That's not what it says. What it says is, I admitted I'm powerless over alcohol, dash, my life had become unmanageable. I now understand that my life is unmanageable because I try to manage it. I try to manage my alcoholism. I try to manage my life. I try to manage my relationships. I try to manage my presences. I try to manage everything. It's unmanageable because of me. And I'm also powerless over alcoholism. That just happens to be a side note. But if this thing was about not drinking, then I would have been better a long time ago. Second part, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Sanity, I didn't know that I didn't have sanity. It was the only normal way of life for me. Matter of fact, the only way that I know that I'm acting insane is if one of y'all, from your perspective, says, hey, dude, it's pretty insane that you're, you know, kind of like leave your job and go to Guatemala for a couple of months. Like, you know what I mean? It's insane. Like your thinking is insane. So I like to bounce my thinking off of you guys. I like to bounce my thinking off other people. And then making that decision to turn our will and our lives over to care of God, as we understood Him. Well, I still don't understand God. I think that's a trick. Bill W. is crazy. I misunderstand God. I don't understand God. And I never ever will. It's just not even on the right plane. But I did make a decision out of desperation to turn my will and my life over to God. And then 2018, I started doing a fourth step, and we did it with columns. We did it with columns this time. I went left. I did a five-column inventory, and I did the people, and I did the reasons, and I did the bottom line, or the instinct, and then I did my part, which I don't really like my part. And then I did the defects, which who would have thought it was connected, right? So now there's defects associated with this thing. And I remember I was out again, and it almost happened again, y'all. I was in the middle of my inventory, and I got busy with work. I got busy with life and things like that. And I'm in the middle of having an inventory, and I stalled, and I'm going crazy. And I remember I had a friend that was doing the inventory with me, and that's cool because we can do things like that. And I had a friend who was doing an inventory with me, and he said, "Let's go talk to Todd. Todd's big. Todd's rough." Todd's like, "Hey, man, I'm Todd." And I'm like, "Todd, I'm going crazy." He's like, "What are you doing?" He's like, "I'm in the middle of my inventory." He's like, "Well, why don't you finish with it?" And I said, "You're going to give me $200. If you don't finish your inventory." I was like, yeah, I'm going to do that. So he motivated me to finish it. Didn't relapse. You know, Todd had my back, man. And then I come to Todd. I said, "Todd, man, I got my inventory. All the people I have resentments with are on paper." He's like, "What about the other three inventories?" And conveniently forgot about that part. I don't know if y'all have ever written an inventory before. There's four of them. You guys are crazy. Why don't y'all do that to us? That's what I was thinking. But surely I did the sex inventory, which was not as spectacular as I thought it would be. I did the, you know, harms to others inventory, and I did, you know, I did a fear inventory, which I'm still curious as to how that works. But we did that, and I did the inventory with my sponsor, and that's the first time I really experienced freedom. I got from that what I wanted out of drinking. Reading this to my sponsor, I got free. That's the first time I'd ever felt free. That's the first time that thing in my gut had ever been released without taking a drink. That's it. And that's what I did. So then we got to learn about defects, and defects are a fun thing because it turns out that, yeah, I mean, sponsors get to beat us up for a little while, but it turns out that there's an opposite part to the defect. There's an antonym. So if I'm acting out a defect, it's just the positive part of me that I'm selfishly doing, and I get to pray that stuff in. And I get to actually learn that I'm actually a good person, a child of God, and people love me, and all these beautiful things, and I'm actually in a place where the static is gone, where I can believe it. And then I started making some amends, and the amends is where the magic really started happening. I remember I never really understood what the financial part in those promises was until I made a financial amend, and it took every cent that I had. I had about $2,000, and that was a lot. That's a lot of money. And I just started investing, and I took, you know, I made a financial amend to a creditor, and I called my sponsor. I said, "Can you believe this is BS? These guys, it's a hospital bill from 10 years ago, and I took an ambulance." He's like, "Records from the past." And I was like, "Okay." So I got some money orders. I took it down there. I handed them the money orders and said, "This is all I got." They said, "We'll take it." Of course they would, because it was their money. Who would have thought that they just wanted their money? But I walked out of there feeling free as a bird. I made some other amends to family members. Some didn't work out too well. Some went really well, and I just continued on the steps. And then I'll tell you, there's a couple of things that that happened that I could really harp on. But after I finished working the steps, it really just wasn't that hard. It wasn't what I thought it would be. I met a girl in AA. The type of girl that, fellas, the type of girl that you say, "I'm going to become the type of man or woman like that is looking for." I met her, and I decided that I was going to be the type of man she was looking for. And it turns out she was an alcoholic as well, so, and maybe a little bit of Al-Anon. So I married her, and we're now married, and we have one child. The child was tough, so things went really smooth for a while. I had some sponsees, we're working the steps, I'm doing good in career. And then we got pregnant, and things started going wrong in the pregnancy. And this was scary. I've made a jump in career. I'm a commission-based salesman. And what I'm doing now is I'm going to make sales to support my family, which is scary because I might not win. There's nobody saying, "Oh, you're going to get this paycheck no matter what." If I don't progress, I don't eat. And so Cassidy, we got pregnant, and the child stopped growing, and they put my wife in the hospital, and I'm out here in my first year trying to sell this service that I just didn't really care about. And I'm telling you, this brought me to my knees. And again, I was surrounded by members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was loved through this. I was held. I was carried through this. And I felt so alone. I felt so crazy. You know, we were pretty sure we were going to lose the baby. We didn't know what was going on. But one day, somehow I stayed positive. I had peace. I had never prayed this hard. I had never done this. And this is how, when I say I don't understand God, He gave me this to develop a relationship with Him that was beyond anything that I could possibly think. Because I prayed harder. I had more experiences. And I stayed on my knees until I couldn't get up again. And I went out there and somehow was successful. And I went out there and somehow able to be a husband, and I was able to take care of my wife, and I was able to do all this. I would cry on the way to my sales meetings. I would cry on the way back, but I did it, man. And I did it without drinking. And that was impossible. And so my wife is in the hospital, and then suddenly I get a phone call, and she's like, "Hey, everything's good." An hour later, no, it's coming. Emergency cesarean. I take off, and it's the only time in my life on this road that two cars are driving the speed limit side by side, because I live on a speedy road. And I'm like getting there, like, I get in the hospital, like, "Look, there's Dad. It's in the middle of COVID, and here we are." I go running in there, and they're like, "Hey, there's Dad." They throw me some scrubs. I take the foot cover, I put it on my head, and I put everything wrong, but I'm here, man. I'm showing up. I'm showing up for life. This is my family, man. Like, let's do this. Like, we're going to make it. She's here. And we get in there, and they're laughing at me because I have all the stuff, and they help me get my scrubs right. And it's in the middle of COVID. I thank God for this, because there's nobody in the operation room. Nobody. No guests, no nothing. And I remember sitting down and just, there was silence. And everything slowed down, and I said, "All right, God, you got it. Let me be your vessel. You got this." And it was silence, and I felt this peace. Just felt this peace that I never experienced. I felt this peace come over me, and I sat there for the 30 minutes, which should have been nerve-wracking, but I made a few texts. Called a few people, and just sat there in silence. And I went in there, and we had a baby. They cut her on out. We had a baby, and the baby cried. She went, "Bah!" So I was like, "Cool, she's alive. Good. Here in the NICU." So we had a baby, and she spent a little bit of time in the NICU, which was a huge relief, because that way we knew that she was taken care of. And we got her home. She was on oxygen for a while. She was on feeding tube for a while. And we got her off the feeding tube, and she took her first steps Easter Sunday. So, yeah. And that, And she's my little heart, my little joy, and we're just a normal little family here. Then, while all of this was going on, my second year as a commissioned salesman for this company, I get a phone call, or I get a text from somebody, and remember, my mother was an alcoholic, and I hated my mother. I truly hated her. I thought I did. That it was rage. And I get a call from one of her best friends that was in the program with her. Her name's Linda. And Linda calls and she says, "Hey, I'm looking for the type of service that you provide." And I was like, "Wait, are you Linda?" And she's like, "Yeah, are you Nick? Oh my God, I thought you were dead. Oh, ha, ha, ha." Cool stuff. Well, she was her mom. Like, when we get sober, sometimes we make a friend. And sometimes that friend stays with us, and we all stay together. It's like our bestie, and like we do life together in this program. And that's like what happens in this program. Like, we have friends, and it's like a closer relationship than a brother or sister. This was like to my mom. I grew up with this lady. I grew up with her son. Like, we were family, right? 20 years later, like last year, she gets in touch with us, and she says, "Hey, yeah, I'd like to like meet you and talk to you and see what's going on." So I went to meet her. Well, my mother was dying. She was dying, and she, my perspective was, she was just into religion and cool, good for her. But she decided, she asked me to make a video, a movie with her before she passed, and she wanted me to show it to the family and wanted me to have something to remember her by. She just made a video, she put it on a CD, and then died a few months later, and the one video was her talking, and the other video was us talking, and her telling me that the chemo wasn't working, and she wasn't gonna make it. It was a video of that, and I was 17. I couldn't really understand it. Well, it turns out this Linda had kept this video all these years. I hadn't heard my mother's voice in probably, I think, 17 years. And so I went over to visit her, and I asked her if she had it. She said, "Yeah, I'll find it." And she found it. She gave it to me. And this is how powerful my perception of the past was at the time. I looked at it, and I couldn't bring myself to watch it. I couldn't bring myself to watch it. So I went to this men's retreat at Rock Eagle, and I sat down, and all of it emptied out. It was all welling up, but all of it emptied out. And I sat there and I did the work. I did the work that was necessary. And I sat with my sponsor. I don't know what work we did, but whatever it was, it worked. I don't know. It worked. And I cried and I was like, I can't do this. And I found out this and this and this. And I found out that I had a child's sense of my past. And I hated my mother for being exactly what I was, an alcoholic. It wasn't her. It was the disease. But I didn't know that. And so I went, when I came right back, they had to get together, and it was all these members of this program. I thought I was trudging the road all by myself, all alone. It was all these members of the program talking to me about women that my mother had sponsored. women who had experiences because of this. I mean, I'm talking like I would not have been able to handle this at 1 or 2 or 3 years sober. You know, I was barely able to handle that day. I'm just in awe because I'm talking to all these people and they're telling me who my mother was, and it's completely contradictory to who I thought she was and who I saw and who I felt and who I hated. And it broke. It broke that day. So because of this program, I was completely able to rewrite my past. Completely able to rewrite my relationship with my mother, and I can look back at a woman I'm proud of. You know, they told me stories about how, like, I know it's probably nothing, but this one lady was telling me a story. She's like, yeah, I was getting a divorce, and your mom would drive by the guy's house, and I would take the pictures of the fence because he wasn't paying child support. Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, that's my mom. That's my mom, man. Yeah, she would do something like that. I had no idea she had touched these people, and these people are still touched by her. And so I found out by God that I don't understand. I'm just walking in her footsteps. I'm just following her lead. She trudged the road. I just showed up. And so I went home and I got to watch the movie and I got to hear my mother's voice for the first time in 17 years. And man, I'll tell you what, she is country. I had no idea. Mom was a country bumpkin, I'm telling you. But a beautiful woman, and I wish I could play it for you guys. If you heard her just grace and what she was saying, she's dying. And she's like, I'm not scared of death. I'm scared of what's going to happen to my children. And you could hear it. Like, some people say, I'm not scared of death. Like, oh, I'm scared. That was me. Oh, I'm scared. No, I'm scared. I'm terrified. Like, don't shoot me, please. She was like, I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid because of my relationship with God. And it started with an alcoholic song. She's not afraid of where she's going. She's just not. She wasn't going to live like that. She was in complete acceptance. If there ever was such a thing as a miracle, that by making this decision to hold this dude's hands in a jail cell and say, which I thought was super awkward, and say the third step prayer would lead me to hear my mother's voice again, because there's only one CD 17 years later, that's a God that I don't understand. You know? That I don't understand. And throughout all this, the urge, the desire, the need has been lifted. I do not need a drink of alcohol. I think about it sometimes. I think about it, I'm like, I take it or leave it. I'm the dude who goes and spends 6 or 8 days in the ward, and they say, you can never drink again, your livers are shutting down, and your kidneys are shutting down, because you take all this weird mental health medication, you drink on top of it, and you're going to die if you do it anymore. I'm like, yeah, I'm never going to drink again. I'm never going to do it. And then as soon as I get home, I'm walking. Like, as soon as Dad goes and takes his eyes off me, I'm running to the store to get me some more alcohol. Like, I'm that guy. Because it makes sense to me. It makes sense. I got to drink. And I no longer have the desire to drink. My desire today is to surrender. My desire today is to do this. And when I took those first three steps, something happened. I didn't do this. Those first three steps, believing that my life is unmanageable and that I need a power greater than myself to manage it, and actually making the decision and taking action to put my life in the hands of something other than myself, was the transformative power. That is all I got, man. Guys, thank you so much.
Thank you, Nick. That was excellent.
My name is Gary. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Gary.
We have a chip system here for the high cost of low living. And we have a white chip. Would anyone like to join our way of life or come back for making your story more legendary than it already was? We've got 30 days that anybody is proud of. All right, we got 60 days. All right, we got a red chip, used to be the color of my eyes. Nobody? Okay, no takers there. We got the sunshine chip for six months. All right, we've got the kudzu chip. The vines of the program are growing on you after 9 months. No takers there, and then so let me see. Do we have any birthdays? We have a birthday over here.
Hey, I'm Adam. I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah.
And I have the pleasure of giving my sponsor a chip. Tim has been my sponsor for the last 20 months. He taught me how to pray. He taught me how to work the steps. Every time I called, he has answered. He's helped me learn how to do this thing. And I think most recently, I've had the blessing of working with my first sponsee. And that's given me, because I'm working step one with him, that's given me a newfound appreciation for the example that Tim set for me as I'm kind of, you know, reviewing old lists and that sort of thing. And Tim's helping me do that, you know, like everything else. And so I'm so grateful to be able to give Tim his chip tonight.
Thank you, Adam. I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. It's 16 years. My sponsor, Tim Moore, I owe it all to him. Of course, he always says the exact same thing about me. It's worked out for us, you know, this sponsorship relationship. The way it happened is my sister, Pam, who's sitting right there with the blonde hair, beautiful young lady here. She had come by. I was living in her house up in Gainesville, hiding out on the lake. She comes by and says, "How are you doing?" I said, "Not good." She goes, "What's wrong?" I said, "I can't stop drinking." There had been an intervention the year before, and I was a worse drinker than the person in the family that went to Richie. And I figured they were coming after me, so I just white-knuckled it, and I didn't drink for like 14 months. But then when I gave myself permission, I don't really want to drink, so maybe I can take a drink. You know, I started romancing it, and I put a date out there, and I went and treated myself to a dinner, a glass of wine, drank like a gentleman. Next week, all I thought about was, when's the next time I'm going to have a drink? And I did the same thing. And, boy, I felt terrible after that second one. And I just went to the liquor store in like 3 days, and it was on. And it was like 4 months of drinking and hiding and sneaking and blacking out everywhere. And she just showed up at the perfect time and asked me how I was doing. And I just was honest. And so for some reason I had a desire to stop drinking. I'd never gone to AA. And she said, "I know exactly what we're going to do." And I discovered that I had a desire to go to AA. Somewhere along, you know, that long ride from Gainesville to here, and we show up to a speaker meeting, and this guy is telling his story. I recognize him after he says a few things, and he went to Sandy Springs High School. I went to Sandy Springs High School. He went to the treehouse. And I was like, "Oh, yeah." I was his bootlegger and dope dealer. And his big sister was my girlfriend. And he and his little buddies financed my romance in high school. And he's standing here sober. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. When they offered the white chip, I said, "This is God putting me right here, right now. I better pick up that chip." And I picked it up, and I felt something powerful. And then Tim Moore gets a big book for us. He said, "When you get home, get on your knees and ask your higher power for strength not to drink tonight." And I'm like, you know, I think I said something like, "Well, I've been trying to pray, man. I've been praying. It just don't work." And he said, just try it. Just keep it simple with the higher power." And so I did it. And then I crawled in bed with that big book, and I read a couple of sentences. And for the first time in months, I fell asleep. And I slept all that night. I didn't have cotton mouth when I woke up. I was sober. I wasn't sober, but I hadn't had a drink that day. And that was my first, and I was working on my first 24 hours. Thank God, you know, this was my spiritual kindergarten now. But they said, just concentrate on the meetings. Just go to the meetings. And I did that for as long as I possibly could. They gave me enough rope. They said, now it's time to get a job, start paying some bills, kicking in and all that stuff. And it's been working out. But Tim took me to see my great-great-grand sponsor, Papa Bill, up at 8111. And I thought he was talking about Bill Root, really, at first. And I show up, and there's this real saintly guy sitting there. He just was aglow, and he meets me, and he says, well, your name's Tim, his name's Tim. Maybe it'll work out for you. Are you happy, joyous, and free? And I said, not yet, but I want to be. And he said, I bet you keep working with this guy, and you will. And when I left, I had a desire to work the steps. And I really wanted to work the steps. I think that was the turning point. Because this Papa Bill, I thought I was 53. I was 53. I thought my life was over. And then I hear that Papa Bill gets his first white chip when he was 63. And he lived till he was over 90 and sponsored hundreds of guys. I was fortunate to be part of that lineage. And so I wanted to work the steps. And today, thanks to people like Adam, who's doing the deal, and my friend Tinsley, who was telling his story with the first month I was here, and I knew this program was for me. If he could do it, I could do it. I'm happy, joyous, and free. And thank you, Nate. What a great story. Man, I got God bumps while you were talking. It was a spiritual experience. Thank you.
the time.